Supply Posse. If we were to provide you with some PayPal details or perhaps Buy Me a Coffee details, would you be interested in making a one-off payment to support us? In return, you'd be helping to keep the podcast going and would also get access to our bonus episodes. Let me know what you think via kim@artsupplyposse.com or via Instagram.
If you've been listening for a while, you'll know how much I love speaking to an artist who was recommended to me by a listener. There's something uniquely special about bringing you conversations that are tied in one way or another to you, the listener. If there is someone you want me to talk to, you can reach out via email, kim@artsupplyposse.com or via Instagram DM. I really love hearing from you and love bringing you those conversations that you're a part of. As I introduce her, I am wondering, is she the first Canadian artist I've spoken to? I'm actually not quite sure, and there's a little tiny part of me that feels like maybe not, but because I can't remember, I'm just going to say, yep, she is, because why not, right? Nikki Trakos, welcome to the Art Supply Posse. Thank you so much for joining me. We had fun getting our dates and our times organized, given we are so far away from each other. So I really love that we've managed to make this work, and we're going to start talking art.
Thanks for having me, Kim. And yeah, I think finding that perfect time and making everything work really came at the right time. So I'm glad it worked out. And I'm the first Canadian artist. Woohoo!
Yeah. I think you are. I was thinking about it and I'm like, I can't, no one else comes to mind. And please, if you are, and I've spoken to you and I've forgotten, I am so sorry. But you know, that's also life and that's what we do. And I'm just going to run with, no, I haven't. And Nikki's my first Canadian artist and die on that hill.
Yay. I love it. Well, we have to thank another Nikki for introducing us too, because
yes,
you are too.
Yeah, Nikki Normandale. She's so excited for this conversation. We chat via, I have a Discord group, and we chat via there. And she messaged last night. She's like, "Have a look," and she sent me a screenshot. Your newsletter listening to was the Art Supply Posse. She's like, "Have a look at this," and I'm like, "That's because I'm talking to her in the morning." She's so excited. So it's lovely. Just these little connections that are sort of made all over the place. Like I love finding artists myself and asking them to join us, but there is just something next level about a listener reaching out and saying, this person whether I've done one of their courses or I've seen them on Instagram or whatever, and I really admire their work and I really love what I've learned from them, I'd love to hear more from them. And then me finding them, asking them to join, and then like you're doing now, having this conversation, it's really kind of special, and it's such a privilege to be able to do. I just love it.
Yeah, and I'm a big consumer of podcasts, so you've come on many morning walks now since Nikki reached out and shared your podcast with me. So, and again, I think it is magical when technology allows us to connect and we're able to share each other's perspectives on art, on life, creativity, whatever it is, because although we're in completely different parts of the world, there's always that same underlying theme or themes.
Yep.
Right, that we can share. Yep. So
exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I always say to everyone, as long as we somehow keep the topic related to art in some way, shape, or form, there's no rules. So it's really cool. We can just talk art, or we can talk like life, and then just mention the word art, and we're good. We don't have any rules. We don't have anything strict, other than probably the most important question, I guess, which is, who exactly is Nikki Trakos?
That's a big question. Currently, this iteration, at this point of my life, I am, so first and foremost, of course, an artist. I've always been drawn to art and had a knack for it and a passion for it, although didn't always practice art. It wasn't until I turned 40, in fact, that I really dedicated my time to creating art and making it sustainable so that I could have it be something that sustains my family, sustains me. And since then, so that was probably 10 or 12 years ago now, I currently call myself an artist, an instructor, and a new author. So spreading my passion for art and teaching others how to make art simple and approachable has really become I would say my biggest priority and my focus with art. And I'm also a mom. I have two full-grown kids who are also following creative paths, and family is a big part of my life. I'm a mom to a dog who spends a lot of time with me in studio and out in nature, which is also something I'm inspired by. And I'm addicted to chocolate and coffee. In a nutshell, that's Nikki.
So you did mention something that I was going to bring up later, but why not bring it up now, which is the fact that you're also a new author, which is so incredibly exciting. Let's talk about that, because you do have a book like that's on pre-order now that'll be available to actually purchase and own very shortly in the next couple of months, I think it is. And of course, you have already published a book. So I'm curious to know, what's that process like? Like the book yeah, creation, like from the idea right through.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a bit of a story. So I've always been like, I'm a book lover. I love paper. I love holding books and flipping through pages and, you know, including sketchbooks and things like that. So books have always been a big part of my life. I look to books for if I want to learn something, if I want to explore, you know, an idea, a topic, or just fall into a story. So for me, I had a dream early on. I thought, wouldn't it be great to be a children's author and illustrator? And then that was sort of pushed to the side because my artistic journey wasn't clear. I didn't know I could do anything with my art. So that kind of felt like a dream, but something someone else does. And, you know, fast forward to present time, books were something that I thought, I'm always carrying books around with me. I have stacks everywhere to refer to, whether I'm looking for references to paint and draw, or again, if I'm learning currently, I'm trying to hone in on my portrait drawing skills. So I have just a dozen of different types of books on drawing portraits and things like that. So for me, I'm very passionate about books and teaching. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to be able to have a companion where people can take a book with them and learn about watercolor or whatever that sort of struggle that they're having if they are trying to learn how to draw or not sure what to paint. So I decided to learn how the publishing world works and the difference between self-publishing and having books traditionally published. So 2021, I guess I really dove in deep, and I took an online course through GoodType. It was called Artist to Author, and it was such a well put together program. I've encouraged them to put it together again and to offer it up because there were so many different artists and new authors, authors who had been published multiple times. There were editors, just the whole gambit of what a published book looks like, whether you're self-publishing or traditionally publishing. So I thought, oh, I'm going to try the self-publishing, and I do really want a traditionally published book, but let me see what Amazon, you know, can offer and what kind of resources and tools can I make for artists so that I can help them, whether it's, again, sketch or draw. So while I was working on a few of my own books that were self-published and had great success. And I think the tool itself was really welcomed by my community of artists. I was offered a book deal through a publishing company, a traditionally published book, and it allowed me to work on a greater in-depth experience with this new book that's coming out in November. So it's been interesting to see how both work. And I can talk a little bit more about the traditionally published book or
you let me know. I think it's an interesting thing because it's never been easier, I guess, to publish a book than ever before, right? Like this is technology and what it gives us. But then there is still clearly value in actual traditionally published books. Is that because, I guess, without getting too detailed, because I don't want to do that, but is it because the money that they offer, or is it because they have departments of people that can work on this as opposed to Nikki on her own working on a book? Like, is that sort of what it is?
You actually, the last point I would say is probably the biggest pro to working with a publisher, a traditional publisher, because as you know, with, you know, and I'm sure all the artists tuning in will appreciate this, but we work really independently on our skill and on our craft. And that can feel isolating. You know, often we don't have someone that we can bounce ideas off of unless we're lucky to have studio mates or supportive partners or other creative friends. So when you're working on a project, like whether it's building a course or designing art that you want to release or planning a book, it's who do you go to? Who's your sounding board to help guide you? I was very fortunate. My editor was just so supportive and allowed me a lot of freedom, but helped me make decisions along the way if I kind of was unsure. And then, of course, there are book designers who their specialty is to lay out the interior of the book. And then, you know, they have resources for guidance with marketing a book as well. And what does that look like? And what's the plan look like? So you're really working with a team of people to help create the best possible product for the end user, who's the reader, the artist. And that was really neat to experience that. I learned a ton. And I think I would still love to do a little bit of both just because I like to do a variety of things. And I think I'm very drawn to the new and exciting project. So to self-publish a book, I can do it a little bit more quickly. And I'm not worried. You know, we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, things aren't perfect. So if the book isn't perfect, or if there's, you know, tiny tweaks that I feel like I could make, I'm okay with releasing it out into the world because the overall purpose of that book is really to help an artist along on their art journey.
I didn't quite deep dive enough, but your self-published books, or even I guess the traditional published one as well, do you have an ebook component of that as well, or is it the physical in-hand book only?
Yeah, so I do offer the ebook version of my self-published books. It makes me nervous just because, of course, with you know, artists being copied online and all of that, I'm worried about how many times my book has been shared, you know, on. That happens with art. I try not to focus too much attention on it, but there are parts of the world where they don't have access to book. They don't have delivery like Amazon does in North America, or I'm sure Australia. So I want to make that available to everybody. I don't want there to be barriers because they can't get access to a printed version. And I think that outweighs the fear of, oh my gosh, I hope no one's copying this, right? I try to focus on that. And the publisher does offer the book via Kindle. Do you have Kindle? It's like your e-reader?
Yeah.
So they do offer that e-book version as well.
Yeah, I think it's nice. Like your fears are valid, but it's a combination of reaching more people, but also I do know, and it's not me because I love books and I will never not have books in my house, but there are quite a lot of people who just prefer an e-book. You know, because it doesn't take up room. Mm-hmm. So if they're in a smaller house or whatever, they don't have, you know, they don't have to worry about having 100 books trying to find room for them because they're all on their device. So it's a bit of both, I think, too.
Absolutely.
So the book process is exciting. You also have courses and things, online education, which I'm really quite interested in. And part of that is when Nikki mentioned you or recommended you, that was one of the things she said was what she learned from you when she found you on YouTube. You helped her to, and now I'm paraphrasing because, of course, I don't remember the conversation exactly as it went, but basically you helped her to see what she was wanting to create in a way that nobody else had done that before and it made sense to her. Which is I would imagine is an incredibly powerful thing to know that you're helping, because you won't be the only person you've helped. She's not the only one, of course. But that must be pretty cool to hear that you've helped someone get art in a way that they just hadn't before.
As you're saying that, I'm like, oh my gosh, I kind of got chills, right? Like I have been very blessed, especially during the pandemic. That's really when I feel like Watercolors Made Simple is that first course. And it's also the title of the book that's coming out November. But it's, you know, I have a philosophy around making art because I felt like I was so intimidated for many, many years by, you know, wanting to become an artist, never mind calling myself an artist. So when I started to deliver courses, I really wanted it to be simple for people. I wanted people who had a passion to try art to have permission to practice in a very non-judgmental, non-stressful environment. I wanted them to be okay with painting and maybe not liking what they've painted, but having success and really enjoying the process of it and really leaning into the title or the feeling of being an artist. So I've been very fortunate to have people like Nikki in my life. And that's what inspires me. It's those messages of, I didn't think I could do it, or I can't believe I painted that. And I've been brought to tears by some of the beautiful messages that I've been witness to. So it never gets old. I'm always, you know, blown away by it and feel very lucky that I can share my perspective. And it's, you know, I don't think it's anything unique other than my favorite saying, and I think my students will agree, is like, it's okay. If, you know, if you don't love something, oh, that's okay. Oh, yeah. Or I'm quite pleased if something turns out well. And I think that permission, because we live in a world where social media is just so prevalent and we're looking at everyone's final result, that we don't see all of the, you know, experiences where we sat down to make art and nothing worked, or we weren't happy, or it was the process of practice that got them to that point. So in courses, I feel it's a very intimate setting where I show them, I don't redo and I don't edit, but I show them the process of the lesson. And if it works out, that's great. And if it doesn't, I'm like, that's okay. And I find positive moments within those pieces as well.
Well, I think you learn as much from when it doesn't work as when it does. Like,
yeah, even more you know, so, what I feel.
I just do think that, like, I know the thing is we want our art to be, like, right. Like, we want it to work out because we've invested time and money and supplies and all those sorts of things. But so when it doesn't work out, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. It just means, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's you don't have the skills yet, or I sometimes actually think when I'm creating something, if it hasn't worked out as I thought and or I'm not happy with it, I think sometimes it's because I was trying to force it. Do you know what I mean? Like I've gone, right, I'm sitting down and doing this, and then it didn't work out. I'm like, well, that's because you were forcing the art instead of just sort of letting it come.
Mm-hmm. We put that pressure on ourselves. I find that still happens when I'm working on pieces that are meant to be finished, framed, etc., hung. There's a little bit more pressure, and it doesn't flow as easily because we're not as relaxed. And, you know, in that moment, we're thinking about the end result. So it still happens to me, and that's natural. And even it's the mood. So if you're, you know, feeling stressed the day that you're sitting to paint, or if you're not, you're feeling under the weather, or there's distractions, right? There's so many variables that can affect our experience when we're creating art. So I think we just need to let go of that pressure and learn how to let go of that pressure, because it's a process.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So I am curious to know, what is it about watercolor that speaks to you specifically? Like, so, you know, what is it that it gives you that perhaps another art supply or an art material doesn't give you in the same way?
So I did calligraphy and dip pen calligraphy for a little while, actually quite a bit. I would say maybe 2 or 3 years. And when I started to play around with watercolor with my dip pens, I was just really falling in love with the texture and how watercolor, if you let it do its thing and flow and follow, you know, petals or brush strokes, and let those brushstrokes dry, there is beautiful texture that happens naturally without very little effort. Again, like it's letting the medium do its thing while controlling it slightly and then really allowing the personality of the medium to come out, that can only be achieved with watercolor. So I felt it was a little bit mysterious in that it really does have a mind of its own sometimes. But if you have a little bit of patience, which I'm not normally a patient person, but I really do slow down when I'm painting with watercolor, and I take my time and I observe what the medium is doing and then just encourage it a little, the end result can be really textural, have beautiful transparencies and opacities throughout it. And I paint with acrylics and oils, and this is the only medium that allows me that really gorgeous, just textury, beautiful paint when it's dry. I'm actually looking at a painting of a pigeon that I did in my sketchbook this morning. And again, like the way the paint dries into the texture of the paper. Yeah, it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous medium if you allow it to be.
Do you have a preference for like what subjects you're creating artwork on? Like, is it sort of open to everything? Because I know some people sort of like to, like, they pick their medium and then they will then drill down further, and I don't know, they might sketch buildings or they might you know, animals or whatever. Like, is there something you really, really constantly, and this may be simply, in actual fact, it may even be not so much that you love it more than anything else, but when you're just wanting to sit down and do a painting, but do it for no reason other than your painting. So it's not a commission, or it's not a piece for your book, or it's not a piece for a course. It's just, it's simply making a piece of art for the sake of it. Is there something you find yourself drawn to as a subject more than anything else?
I'd say there's two that are predominant, and they show up in my sketchbooks often. And one for sure are wildflower botanical, lots of green leaves and stems and things like that. So flowers for sure, but not like it's not necessarily a peony or a hydrangea. It's stems of just wild flowers that are muted in tone and have definitely a vintage vibe to them. That's if I sit down and I just sketch and without reference, put pencil to paper and then paintbrush to paper, that's what comes out for sure very often. Yeah. And the other, I would say, are moody landscapes, and they can be abstracted, they can be realistic, but moody landscapes and muted tones for sure. Like, that's another one of my love languages, I think.
Do you need something as a reference to create, or is it in your mind what you want? Because I know some people find that, especially if they're new to an art supply, an art material, art practice, they get a little bit caught up in, if I'm using a reference, whether it's a photo, whether it's an image online from a book or whatever, they're like, they sort of think it's copying, which I disagree with wholeheartedly. And I think it's totally fine. But, like, are you using references, or are you using an image in your mind, or is it just sort of coming to you as it comes to you?
Yeah, I agree with you on that, Kim. I think that it's okay to use references and to copy them, trace them anytime you can. You're just creating that muscle memory, and you're putting to memory characteristics of what you're examining and observing. So I'm totally with you on that. I do both. So it depends. I'm currently trying to explore different motifs that I am working on. So for instance, I painted a polar bear. I thought, I've never painted a polar bear. What does that look like? How would I express the fur? So I had a visual reference for it. So because I'm not familiar with what the characteristics of a polar bear are, so that I can mimic that in my painting. But the way that I approach art now, and this is something that came with experience and something that I hope to share with the community through my classes, is observation puts to mind what your painting, what you're exploring. And then you'll do it so many times in that repetition and practice. So if I want to paint a bird, I'm going to look at images of birds. I will pick up a book because I do have books with images of birds or photos of birds in them. I'll go online and look at images and references, and I'll examine it so much that after I've practiced drawing and painting it so many times, I'll remember the curves of a bird's head or what the feather pattern looks like. So I love having visual references around me because they inspire me, and sometimes I use them, but if it's something that I'm very familiar with, I can just paint from memory.
Yeah. That process of painting, especially if it's something new, like you mentioned about the polar bear, that must be completely different to painting, you know, your botanicals, for example. Does it require a different level of attention, not only because it's new, but because fur has a completely different appearance and feel and texture to petals of a flower, for example? So does that sort of challenge you? Is it hard? Is it easy? Like, what's that kind of like?
It is definitely different, especially when working in watercolor. You have to think about how can I emulate texture when I don't want the feel of the watercolor to lose its transparency. I don't want it to become too opaque, because you can layer watercolor quite easily. But I want the watercolor to feel like a watercolor painting. So playing around with creating texture, let's say use the polar bear, for example, I often use negative space. So instead of being very detailed with the body of the polar bear, I'll bring in details just around the silhouette to mimic fur, to make it feel like it's, you know, covered in fur, but I'll leave a lot of negative space as well, and let the watercolor dry in that texture beautiful way that it does. But it is definitely a different approach, and I think that's the thing. I get bored, so for me, I like new. I like the new and shiny. So for me, if it's a bit of a challenge, I'm up for it. I think I would get bored painting a botanical piece every single time I sat down to paint. It's just me. Whereas some people, they love that, being in that comfort zone and that familiarity and knowing, you know, what their process is like. Whereas I'm kind of like, okay, did that. What am I going to do next? That's why I have so many sketchbooks, so many different types of mediums. It's like a little bit, it can be crazy at times, but that seems to be so.
So how this is a subject that I love, this exploration of different mediums and different subjects within one medium and stuff like that. How do you encompass that in your practice? Because I'm guessing at the moment that art is your full-time career. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how do you then go, okay, I want to explore something slightly different, but I still do need to be working on, you know, working on the new book or working on a new course? Like, how do you kind of manage it all?
I don't know if I do. honestly, I don't know if I do, you know. And it's when I started Life by Design, and I wanted to be an artist, a working artist, and I wanted to demystify the whole starving artist persona. You know, I was told over and over again, whether it's classes I was taking or books I was reading, that you had to have a recognizable style. Mm-hmm. You needed to stick to, you know, one thing, and you needed to create a collection, and it needed to be all cohesive and coherent. And I could never do it. I always felt like I would get bored. And really, that's truly what would happen. And I felt like, but I have so many interests. Why would I cut that experience short? Or why would I shortchange myself by not, you know, playing with acrylics and creating beautiful textural abstracts, or, you know, wanting to work digitally? So why would I shortchange myself and not allow myself to have that experience? It may not be the right way, Kim. And like I said, I don't know that I do it well enough, but I certainly have tried to balance it and find ways to express all the different parts of the artistic side of Nikki. So I create large pieces. I'm looking at them in my studio wall now. Large pieces of art that I used to participate in group art exhibitions pre-pandemic. So that fulfilled my desire to paint large on canvas and get messy with acrylic paints and pastel markers and all of those great things. So I can compartmentalize maybe, and I won't show that as much on my social media feed, but that in-person experience will allow me to create art and show that art. I also design greeting cards and license my art. And that's something that, again, I may not show, but that fills the side of Nikki where I just need to sit on the computer and maybe play around with the color theme and, you know, a sassy saying for a greeting card or something.
Yeah. So, well, it's interesting because I've heard that a lot myself, this thing that you should specialize and drill down. Mm-hmm. But it's such a limited way of thinking, and it's a boring way of thinking, but also it's not reflective of life. Like, we don't, mm-hmm. our life isn't like one dimensional. So why on earth should our art be?
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. I think about like what I worked on these past 2 weeks, and it was so varied. I worked on a tattoo design last week.
Oh, exciting. Oh, yeah. Cool.
Well, and I think about the jobs maybe I didn't get or the commissions I didn't get because maybe someone opened my feed and thought, oh, you know, maybe there isn't a cohesiveness to her art. But then I think about all the fun jobs that I do get and the fun experiences that I do get to get. And I think as an artist, you have to decide what works for you and what your goal is, and kind of do balance it, right?
Well, you also don't want to get bored because it's not a 9-to-5 job. Like, it's not working as a working artist isn't a traditional, you know, turn up to an office, clock in, do your job, clock out, go home. And whilst I appreciate that not all aspects are going to be enjoyable, there's going to be some stuff that you may not like, and that's just how it is. But it's not meant to be this, well, I don't think it's not meant to be this boring, like, office job. You know what I mean? Like, it should be mm-hmm. interesting, it should be exciting, and it should challenge you. And if that means doing 10 different mediums within the space of a week, well, that's good as far as I can tell, if that's what you want.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I even think back, like, as I'm thinking about what I didn't love to do, and you know, commission painting, like larger pieces. Mm-hmm. And even working on briefs when I was doing freelancing and more design, like surface pattern kind of work, I wasn't good with parameters. And I struggled, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm a failure. I can't do this. But I realized it's the parameters and the constrictive feeling of I need to produce something that someone else has a vision for. So I just stepped back. I don't do commissions anymore. I don't create based on a brief. If someone wants to license or buy a piece of my art, it's a finished product. And that way I stay true to what feels good for me. The process of that art coming to life is more organic. And I'm happier with the outcome of what the piece looks like. But some people thrive on briefs and knowing what color palette to use and what motifs or what imagery they're going to be painting. And that's good. Like, if you can get to the point where you know that about yourself as an artist, you're halfway there.
And the thing is it's a recognition that everybody's different. We all do different things. We all create differently. And if one way works for you and another way doesn't, that's not a problem. That's how you are, and that's how it works. And, you know, like I was, as I mentioned before we started recording, I was browsing your website, and, you know, if I was in the market to purchase a piece of your work, well, all I have to do is go to your website and it's there. I don't need to be worried about, I want to tell her it's got to be this color and it should be that size and it should be this, that, and the other. Like, that works for you, and therefore that would work for your people who are interested in your art, and whether they're, you know, purchases of your art or purchase of your course, they know that going in, like, they're getting, this is the experience of Nikki, and this is how she works, and this is, you know, this is why I'm drawn to her.
Oh, that's good to know. Because like I said, sometimes I feel like trying to cram it all in into one spot. Because there's so many just facets of what I want to present and do and experience. Yeah. So sometimes it can be. I remember I had an art coach that I hired just a little while ago because I wanted to lean into my just the art side of my business again, which I feel mm-hmm. like you have to really focus on one thing. And I focused on creating courses and really leaning into that and the books. And now it's time to go back to my roots a little bit. So I thought, oh, let me hire a coach and we can work together. And she just tore my website apart and gave me her honest critique. And I wrote notes and I absorbed everything she said to me. But then I let go what didn't serve me. I sat with it. I did take a lot of her criticism and or critiques. And I went with it. But then there are some things that just weren't right for me. And that's okay, right? So if we can, we have to be at a point where we're confident enough to be able to listen and then to take what we need and just let go of what doesn't serve us. And I think if that was Nikki 10 years ago, I would have been devastated and I maybe would have stopped making art or it would have stalled my art practice. So I hope that if artists are getting critiques, that they're in a point where they're confident and they can take what they need from them and then just let the rest go.
Yeah, it's a big thing to ask for critique. It can be quite a tricky thing because there is part of it that, of course you want it because you want to learn from it. But also if someone says this isn't good or this doesn't work because of whatever that reason is, and again, it's also subjective because it's that person's opinion as opposed to some kind of rule or whatever. But also I think, I don't know about you, but for me, part of letting go of stuff is I'm getting older and I just don't care as much. If I want to make a thing and I'm making that thing and you don't like it, I don't care really. I'm not, you know what I mean? It's just like, well, that's okay. You don't have to like it. I do. I'm the one that did it and I'm the one that wants it.
I feel curse words coming up.
Lots. We'll keep this clean, shall we? But I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. Like, and I know I've said this before and I will continue and I will die on it, I suppose, die on the hill saying it, but we're not performing brain surgery. We're making art. We've got to love what we're doing because I really think the real measure of success is you love what you're doing. Somebody else loves what you're doing, whether it's one person or 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people. That's all that matters. You don't have to, we're not doing brain surgery.
Oh my God. Yes. I'm like right beside you on that hill.
Excellent. I mean, good company. I like it. I like it. So I do sort of want to circle back to the online courses and the education that you offer, because like with the books, I think the incredible thing about it is it gives anybody, wherever they are in the world, the opportunity to take your course and to learn from you. Is that I imagine it's a big process to sort of create a new course. How do you go, oh, this is a thing that perhaps I should offer? Like, what makes you realize that something you're doing is something of value to somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can maybe talk about just first getting started because it's a little bit different now that I have a creative community. When I first started creating courses, so actually I was a member on Skillshare, which is a creative platform where you can take online classes.
Yep, I love it. It's great.
Yeah, I learned a ton from all of the really talented and giving instructors on that platform. So I thought, you know what? I want to give back to a platform that really helped me start and define Life I Design. I didn't go to art school. I am self-taught. I have cursed and cried and even celebrated through everything that I've learned. So for me, online classes, it was either go to college and spend 3 years to get an art degree or a graphic design degree or whatever it was, or it was let's just, grit our teeth and figure it out. So I thought, let me try teaching a calligraphy class, because calligraphy was something I was passionate about. I knew that I could do it. I had a knack for it. And I think that passion and that knack for it will come through in a class. So I learned how to create an online class. And I took a course to learn how to do that. And then
yeah.
when I got some positive feedback, that's kind of like, oh, it fluffs you up a bit. And you think, oh, if I can help someone on their creative journey, that feels amazing. Like I thought, well, what can I do to make their journey go faster or to be more enjoyable? So I feel like there's just always has to be a passion around what it is that I'm teaching. I have mm-hmm. to really love it. And I think that comes through when you're an instructor. And then there, I have to feel confident that I can deliver the right information and make the process of what the person who's taking the class learns really easy and rewarding. And I want them to have success. So for me, definitely when I look at a class that I want to teach, I think about how interested I am in it and what would I like to see. And then I look to see what the community is talking about. So sometimes it'll stem from ideas that I have. But then these last few classes, really just focusing on sketching. And I really want people to know that they can draw, even if they don't feel like they can draw. I'm going to teach them my cheat ways. Maybe I have a bad habit here or there. And that's the unpolished side. That's not perfect. But I think people appreciate, because I'm not coming in and using highly technical terms or very mathematical approaches to, you know, what I'm delivering. It really is, you know, listen, I've invested so much time, energy, and money into figuring out how to paint using watercolor. I'm going to show you the easiest way so that you paint right away, you have success, and you connect with your medium. And I think, you know, looking at that approach and looking at what people are struggling with has really allowed me to create some fun classes that I think people are enjoying.
Well, the nice thing too is you're giving people shortcuts, maybe is the word, like, but a way to get to a finished piece quicker is a really powerful thing, because I think it hooks you in more. Like, you know, like I have done some courses where it feels like you're taking forever before you even get to do whatever the thing is, and I get bored of that. you know, like you, I get bored easy. Yeah, but if you're saying to me,
let me get dirty.
Yeah. If you're saying to me, here, take this paintbrush and this color, and suddenly you've got a, and it doesn't even have to, like, this is part of the reason why I love abstract art as a whole, is because it doesn't have to resemble something to still actually be really cool. There's something so powerful about that. Like, addiction's not the right word. It's not addicting, but it kind of is. Like, it's like, oh, I want to do this again, and I want to repeat this, and I want to keep going and going and going and learn more. Whereas if it takes you forever to even get to being partway done, it's like, oh, I'm not doing that again.
Mm-hmm. You've lost interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Which is just my way of saying, like, don't make boring courses, people.
Yeah. That's why I try to leave out, like, a lot of the theory at the beginning. I really get into just, okay, this is what we're going to start with. And we're painting right away, whether it's putting brush strokes on paper. I'm encouraging them to use their favorite color and, you know, to paint an entire page full of brush strokes. At least that way they're connecting with the medium. And being in a world where technology is so prominent, and I rely on technology heavily, so I'm definitely of both camps, where I can't live without my technology and I can't live without my paper books, right? I can't live without that tactile process of connecting that side of your brain with what your hand is doing, what's happening on the page, the sound that your supplies make. Like, it really, I want them to experience all of that gorgeous, luscious, you know, part of what art really is, and let them have success right away, rather than bog them down with terms that they're not going to remember or understand. And that's going to make them start to daydream like we did back when we were in like grade 7 math or something.
Well, the other, actually, you've just reminded me of something that I like to do, especially, and I know I'm not the only one, particularly when you buy a new supply, whether it's just a new brand of a thing you already do or it's a completely different thing, which is swatching out that particular supply. So, you know, for example, you buy a new set of watercolors and perhaps it's a different brand or they're just different shades, you've never had them before, and just making marks on paper, on a surface, like, it's doing two things, right? Like, it's letting you see that color, but also it's using it. Like, you're making something, even if it's just simply, you know, marks on a page with the color. It's still creating. It still feels like you're creating something, even though it's just, oh my God, swatching out the colors.
Color swatching is like my favorite thing to do. I could color swatch all day long. And yeah, and that, like you said, it's just, you know, and even getting to know that color. Oh my gosh, like to bring home a beautiful new tube of watercolor paint in a color I haven't used before. I want to get to know you. Like, there's a new romance starting here and we need to get to know each other. I want to know what you're all about, what you look like if I've add more water to you, or what you look like if I mix you with a different color, right? Like, it's,
yep.
And that process, and if you can lean into that, oh my gosh.
It is exciting. And you're right. It is like a new relationship. It's like, oh my goodness, we've got to get to know each other.
Right. And it's funny how, you know, a lot of beginner artists don't do that. And that's one thing in my class, I call it color stories. I'm like, I write it like, this is the story of Payne's Gray, which is happens to be one of my favorite colors. And yeah, I show them how to swatch it and how to get to know it. Payne's Gray, I'm not surprised.
Yeah,
not
surprised. It's just incredible. It's I love it. I love it. Right? I love it.
It's like, it can be moody and, you know, powerful, but then inky and it gets lighter. And anyway, mm-hmm. but yeah, that's like creating this color story and then recording that. But that's something that, again, like, it's a process that artists do, and let's show that. And that's, you know, again, in classes, I can do that. I can show them behind the scenes of, you know, this is how you warm up. This starts to spark ideas, but it also gets you more familiar and confident with your art practice. Because anytime you can use your tools, you are creating experience, you're growing your skill and your confidence. It doesn't matter what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Have you ever actually done in-person workshops, or is it all so far online?
Mm-hmm. So I have pre-pandemic teaching in-person workshops. Actually, it was getting really busy for me, and just being able to connect with people in person and be able to tweak, maybe change hand position, or really being able to demonstrate in person was fantastic. It is something that I am leaning into again. So more so it'll happen in 2024. I think I'm ready for it. And I'm planning on traveling and teaching workshops in person just so I can get out and meet my community and be inspired by other artists and, you know, be able to have chats like these more often. So yes.
Well, if you wanna do an Australian component, I will be right there with you. Yay, I will be first on the list. So you can combine that with visiting family and working. So
there you go. That's what I'm hoping to do, especially with the new book coming out. I haven't seen my family since, oh my gosh, it's been at least 25 years that I was there. About 25 years. So I'm due. I've had family visit here, and I do have very close family that I love, and, you know, Zoom chats and online versions of chats don't do it, but I would love to. So I will definitely hold you up to that. And
absolutely. I look forward to it. Yeah. I'm always up for a visit to Melbourne. So, you know, not going to complain. Let's head towards the end of our conversation. I'm curious to know about you and brands. Are there specific paint brands you love to use? Are you agnostic and just use whatever? And then obviously we've touched on Payne's Gray as being one of the greatest colors in the whole entire world. Are there other colors that you sort of find yourself using over and over again?
Yeah, so in terms of brands, I don't stick to one brand for paper. So let's talk about watercolor specifically, because I think that's what I'm best known for. I don't particularly stick to one brand of paper. I do love to work on cotton paper for finished pieces, but I like to play around with cotton blends because I feel like, you know, when you sit down with a beautiful, expensive piece of paper that you're going to paint on and you feel this restrictive, you know, that pressure of, oh my God, it's very precious. It cost a lot of money. Sometimes it's easy to get over that when you're working on a piece. Sometimes it's not. So I don't like to limit myself to, you know, only painting on the best watercolor paper. I'm okay with painting on something that maybe is a 20% or 50% blend. But when it comes to paint, I'm a little bit of a snob when it comes to watercolor paint. I have a few brands that I absolutely love. I buy them again and again, and I recommend them. So watercolor paints, the Winsor & Newton Professional line, I can count on the opacity, the pigment payoff. I know they're going to last. So when I am painting large pieces that are meant to be, you know, here for a very long time, I can count on how they're going to behave. So I definitely buy tubes of the Winsor & Newton Professional line for sure. However, I also love Daniel Smith's really mineralizing, granulating, gorgeous colors. So Undersea Green is right up there with Payne's Gray for me. So I don't know if you've played with that color.
I haven't, no.
Okay, Undersea Green is a moody, gorgeous, mineralizing and granulating color by Daniel Smith. It comes in a tube as well. And when it breaks apart from itself, there's blues in it and greens and yellows. It's just a gorgeous color to paint botanicals with. Landscapes I painted with it. You can water it down and create a really nice, light, beautiful green, or use it opaque. So it's right up there with Payne's Gray for sure. But their colors are very mineralizing. So they separate, and it's good if you are the type of painter that will allow the medium to do its thing. But if you're a bit tighter and you need the watercolor to behave more, it definitely isn't for that type of painter. But I do love their paints as well. And then in a dry palette, I prefer using a tube, but in a dry palette, there's a brand called Mungyo. It's M-U-N-G-Y-O.
I'm very, very familiar with it. I use and adore their oil pastels. So I'm very familiar with it, just haven't used their watercolors.
Oh, amazing. Well, if you're looking to explore their line, they have a beautiful palette of 24 cake-like pans watercolor that when you hydrate them, add a bit of water, they come to life and they are so opaque and vibrant and beautiful that I'm okay with traveling with those and painting with those. Yeah. So I definitely am a bit of a snob when it comes to pigment. I need it to be really good quality.
That's okay. You're allowed to be. And how about brushes?
Yeah, so brushes, I actually have my own line now because brushes can be a bit of an investment and there's a lot of confusion around which ones to buy. You know, do I get real hair or is synthetic okay? And how much do I spend and what sizes do I need? And I think there are some really great brush lines out there. Winsor & Newton have a great professional line. Princeton has a really great professional line and they're both synthetics, which is great. But the sizes between brushes can really vary. So a number 8 in one brand can be a completely different size and a number 8 in another. So I always say with brushes, shop in person if you can and make sure you spend whatever you can afford on good quality brushes and just take care of them because they will last you forever. I have never thrown a brush away and doesn't matter what medium I'm using. Brushes, I treat them really well. I wash them. I take care of them. I lay them flat until they're dry. And if you find your sweet spot with brushes, you only need 2 or 3, really. You don't need a massive, you know, jar full of different types of brushes. It's just learning how to use them properly. So I would say around for watercolor and maybe 3 sizes, so a medium, a large, and then a fine, you can paint so many different motifs and styles with just those 3 brushes. Yeah. Everything else is extra. Like everything else can make your life easier for sure. But if I, you know, was just starting out and was recommending to someone, it would definitely be just a couple of round brushes, but the best quality and synthetic hair. I have a few real hair brushes that were expensive and I treated myself. They were definitely special occasion buys. But I don't use them very often because I don't love the way that they hold the water. And I don't love that I don't have a really nice defined point. So synthetic all the way.
Perfect. So let's tie this up. Let's end this with a little bit of advice, a little bit of tip or a tip or something. What would you suggest to somebody? They're inspired. They wanna give watercolor a go, or maybe they did it years ago and for whatever reason they didn't take to it, but they want to try it again. What could you suggest to somebody?
Take Watercolors Made Simple. Perfect.
And of course. Cheer you on. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. No. Well, why not?
Why not? I would say just be open to exploring the medium and really get to know what the medium can do. Play around with ratios of water. Really allow yourself lots of time to put brush to paper, working on brush strokes, getting to know how to mix watercolors. And even when you're adding water to the paint, like that ratio is so different for everyone. I can give you a formula, but what you may like to see on your paper is different than what I like to see. So play around with mixing watercolor and observing what it does, and slow down in your process, because watercolor can be very meditative and it changes as it starts to dry. So you can do different things. You can manipulate it differently based on how wet or how dry it is, and just have fun with it. Like no pressure, just really enjoy exploring the medium.
I love it. Nikki, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you online?
Yeah, so lifeidesign.com is the website, and I'm pretty much at lifeidesign everywhere else. Instagram is where I like to hang out mostly. YouTube is where I'm starting to share a nice variety of stuff. So thank you, Kim. This was so fun. I'm glad we made it work despite the time differences and the challenges with technology. It was so good chatting with you.
So wonderful. Thank you.